From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, making comedies that are sometimes gross and sometimes delightful, we talk with the Farrelly brothers, the duo that made Dumb and Dumber, There's Something About Mary, Kingpin, and Shallow Hal. Their new film, Stuck on You, stars Matt Damon and Greg Kinnear as conjoined twins. Also, rock critic Ken Tucker reviews two new stripped-down CDs, the Randy Newman Songbook Volume 1 and the Beatles' Let It Be Naked. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld says the CIA is conducting the interrogation of captured Iraqi leader Saddam Hussein. Rumsfeld didn't say whether Hussein had offered information of value, but U.S. military officials in Iraq say his statements have led them to arrest several Iraqi rebel leaders. Rumsfeld said whatever Hussein reveals, it's still important to search for weapons of mass destruction.
My guess is that if you think about it, that we're not going to find weapons of mass destruction by chugging around. Someone's finally going to come and say something. I don't know if it'll be this year or next year or what.
Followers of Saddam Hussein put on angry demonstrations today. NPR's Julie McCarthy says Saddam's supporters insist his arrest was staged.
Diehard supporters are saying that it was in fact not Saddam Hussein who was captured, but a ruse by the Americans. So the idea that the capture of Saddam was going to quiet violence directed against the coalition troops seems overly optimistic, at least in the short term. And despite his arrest, it would seem that the message from his supporters is that it will be business as usual, violent business as usual.
NPR's Julie McCarthy in Baghdad. A federal panel of science advisors has recommended that emergency contraception, the so-called morning-after pill, should be available without prescription. And the panel voted 23-4 to recommend to the Food and Drug Administration that the pill, sold under the name Plan B, should be available over-the-counter. Supporters of the decision, such as Planned Parenthood, had argued that the bill has been proven safe. Opponents, such as Concerned Women for America, said the bill has not been proven and might discourage the use of contraceptives that also protect against sexually transmitted diseases. France and Germany said today that they'll support the U.S. effort to reduce Iraq's huge foreign debt. The announcement comes after meetings with former Treasury Secretary James Baker, who's working as a special envoy for President Bush. NPR's Don Gagne reports from the White House.
Baker met with France's Jacques Chirac and Germany's Gerhard Schroeder, and both agreed that Iraq needs help with its debt. White House spokesman Scott McClellan called it good news.
We appreciate the commitment by France and Germany to work to restructure and reduce the debt burden on the Iraqi people. We all share the same goal of helping the Iraqi people build a better future, build a future that is free and prosperous.
So far, though, there are no details regarding the amount of debt to be forgiven. It's also not clear what Baker offered France and Germany, or if there will be any change in a White House policy to limit bidding on Iraqi reconstruction projects to countries that supported the war. France and Germany did not. Don Gagne, NPR News, the White House.
In stocks today, the Dow gained 106 points, or 1%, to close at 10,129. The Nasdaq was up 6 to 1924. This is NPR News. The Missouri River has dropped to the lowest level ever recorded at Kansas City. Frank Morris reports from member station KCUR.
Ice dams formed on tributaries of the Missouri last week, choking off water to the river already parched by 4 years of drought. Lows not seen in more than 70 years of record keeping exposed sandbars and the remnants of the first bridge crossing the Missouri. Water utilities and power plants strung along the river are monitoring the situation, but for now are able to draw water, in part thanks to modifications made to compensate for last year's dry season. But Kevin Lau with the Army Corps of Engineers says the worst may not be over.
I would say that chances are good that it would happen again in the near future.
Lau says in the near term, increased releases from upstream reservoirs will likely push the Missouri River above this week's record low levels. For NPR News, I'm Frank Morris in Kansas City.
The Pension Fund for California State Workers, CalPERS, said today that it will sue the New York Stock Exchange and seven of its member trading firms for alleged fraudulent practices. CalPERS, with $154 billion in assets, is the largest public pension fund in the U.S. The CalPERS suit says the specialist trading firms cheated the fund out of millions of dollars by offering inferior prices and trading for their own advantage. The suit accuses the New York Stock Exchange of failing to supervise the specialist trading companies properly. CalPERS officials are asking other big investors to join them in the suit and pursue it as a class action. The lawsuit comes just a day before the New York Stock Exchange board is scheduled to vote on the new governance rules for the exchange. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Sodexo, reminding listeners that more than 31 million Americans are at risk of hunger every day. On the web at helpstophunger.org.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guests are the Farrelly brothers, Peter and Bobby, the duo that made the comedies Dumb and Dumber, Kingpin, There's Something About Mary, Me, Myself, and Irene, and Shallow Hal. Their new film, Stuck on You, stars Matt Damon and Greg Kinnear as Bob and Walt Tenner, conjoined twins attached at the hip. The twins live in a small New England town where they own a diner. Their teamwork has made them the fastest and most popular short order cooks imaginable. When Walt, Greg Kinnear's character, decides he wants to go to Hollywood and become an actor, his brother obliges. Here's the twins having a cup of coffee with an over-the-hill, small-time agent looking for a quick buck who's offered to represent Walt. The agent is played by Seymour Cassell.
I want to let you boys know right up front that Morty O'Reilly only represents actors who are truly committed to their craft.
That's me, Mr. O'Reilly. I am fully committed.
Committed enough to pay my $200 upfront service fee, which, of course, is used to defray the costs of registration fees, entitlement, paperwork, and what have you.
What are you doing? I'm showing him how committed I am.
You're showing him how stupid you are. Here. We'll give you $100, because you're only representing one of us.
Well, I'm going to have to level with you. Siamese twins ain't the easiest sell I've ever had.
We're not Siamese. We're American.
Peter and Bobby Farrelly, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you very much, Terry.
Thank you. Great to be here.
How did you think of the idea of a comedy about conjoined twins in the first place?
This is Bobby speaking, and it was based on a documentary we saw about these two gals. It was back in the 1940s, and I'm sorry, their name skips me right now, but they were conjoined twins, and one of the gals wanted to go out to Hollywood and become an actress, and the other one had no desire to act, but she thought, yeah, you know, I don't want to hold you back. I'll go with you, sure. And the girl actually did go out and got in a few, like, she became sort of a B-movie star. And as we were watching this documentary, we thought, this is a fascinating story. And, you know, I think there's a good screenplay around it somewhere.
Were you concerned that people would take it the wrong way and that they would think that you were mocking conjoined twins?
Not really. This is Peter speaking, by the way. You know, we always, you know, we go into it with our hearts open and we love the characters and we're not afraid to show them, you know, put this full spotlight on them, show, you know, their strengths and their weaknesses. But we always love these characters and we knew that these people were going to be our heroes and we were going to treat them right. And truthfully, it never concerns us. You know, sometimes you worry what the critics will think, but truthfully, over the years, despite all the talk, we have received zero letters from anybody who's been offended by any of our movies, despite what you might read.
Now, for the twins in your movie, who are played by Greg Kinnear and Matt Damon, they're really happy to be attached to each other. They love each other. They have a great time together, and they're really cooperative. One is always making a sacrifice for the other so that the other could do what they want to do, whether it's making a movie or making love. And I'm wondering, what are some of the sacrifices you think you've made for each other so that the other could do what they wanted to do?
Wow.
Well, I'll tell you once the story that Pete did for me just growing up. And my dad came home one time, we were about 11 or 12 years old, and somehow or another he had gotten a couple of tickets to the World Series game, and it was in Pittsburgh. But he only had two tickets. It was one for him and then one for one of us. And he went to Pete and said, look, you're the oldest. I'm going to take you to the game. And Pete said, no, don't take me. You know, take Bobby. And then he said, really? You sure? He said, yeah, he'd love it. And then So my father came to me and said, you know, I got a ticket to the game, the World Series, and I only got one. You want to go? And I'm like, sure. You know, it didn't occur to me to say, no, take Pete. But I was young and dumb. But then later I found out that what Peter had done, thinking of his, you know, his brother before himself, and I've been very grateful ever since. And one day I'll pay you back, Pete.
Well, you know, it sounds a lot better with a little time. But at the time, you know, looking back, I think at the time I just didn't really want to spend that much time with my father taking the trip all the way to Pittsburgh.
Well, let's hope he's not listening now.
No, actually, I'm kidding. Bob was a National League fan, and, you know, my father knew some people who knew people with the Pirates, and I just thought he'd like it more. But by the way, you know, we had a couple of conjoined twins serve as consultants on this movie, Laurie and Dori Chappelle, and we really learned a lot about, you know, we went in under the impression that these people, they must do the same thing, same hobbies, same jobs, and it was far from that. In fact, you know, one of the Chappelle sisters is a country western singer, and the other one worked in a hospital when we were dealing with them, and they had completely different hobbies, and it really was about, you know, giving of each other's time, and in a very thoughtful but sort of innate way. They didn't. It was just such a natural thing for them.
Do you feel that as time goes on, you have less quote gross out humor in your movies and just more? More like funny lines and sight gags and a lot of heart, but that there's less kind of gross stuff.
Well, you know, the truth is, you know, we don't sit down to, when we write a movie, this is Pete again, you know, we don't sit down and think, you know, geez, we had some, you know, we had the hair gel and Mary, and what could we come up here? The first thing we do is we try to create a character or characters that, you know, are so likable that we can hang a lot of our gags on. And then our gags are basically trying to give you the unexpected. You know, when we did Dumb and Dumber and Jeff Daniels walks into the bathroom and sits down, well, you know, up to that point in time, everybody at that, you know, would shut the bathroom door and you'd cut to something else. And we thought, well, how funny would it be just to let it play? And the reason that was funny then, and I don't think it would be funny now, is because of the unexpectedness of it. People could not believe we were actually letting the camera roll while he's on the toilet. Now, if you did that today because of... there's been a lot of this type of thing, it wouldn't be as interesting.
I'm glad you mentioned the now famous toilet scene from Dumb and Dumber. One of the things that's just really hysterical about this scene is that, you know, he's on the toilet, the camera's watching him, he's not only doing his business, he's doing a lot of business. And then, then he finds out from a knock on the door that the toilet's broken and it won't flush. And so he's really stuck. This is, you know, he's not at home. Who hasn't either had that nightmare or had that happen to them? And suddenly it's no longer just, oh, isn't that gross? It's like, wow, this is like a nightmare come true.
You know, it's really interesting to us that how, you know, our country is really very uptight. And, you know, I guess it goes back to the Puritans and all that stuff, but very uptight about anything sexual or any bodily functions or, you know, even things like people with disabilities, they don't want to deal with that kind of stuff, and they find it, you know, this is the kind of stuff that they call gross-out humor, whereas they're very accepting. Our country has a strong stomach for violence. Like, for instance, like in a Coen Brothers movie, and by the way, Coens are the best. We think they're tremendous. But in their kind of movies, when, you know, in Fargo, for instance, when they turn a guy upside down and put him in a wood chipper, that is somehow viewed as arty. And people really, you know, to us, that's gross. But, you know, and bodily functions are just, you know, it's something everybody deals with. People don't deal with people being chopped up in a wood chipper. Yet it seems to be accepted quite readily by the American public.
Well, you're great at doing the things, at showing the things that you're not supposed to let anybody else see, that you're only supposed to do behind closed doors, whether it's going to the bathroom or masturbating. And the idea of how embarrassing it would be if you were seen doing that, or if you were, the after effects of that were seen, is something that you really work with. And I wonder if you guys embarrass easily.
Not so much now, probably.
I don't think we embarrass too easily, but you know, these stories like Jeff Daniels on the toilet are things that have happened to us. They've happened to us, or they've happened to a good friend of ours, and so we try to base all of these sort of embarrassments that happened from something that, you know, that we know to be true. You know, I remember reading an article about that from where Clint Eastwood was talking about Dumb and Dumber, and he said he had that exact same bathroom experience happen to him one time, and he was just on the floor laughing, watching it. And it's just, you know, if it's based in truth, it's funny.
Yeah, and I think that's why Something About Mary works so well. Like, the you know, when people laugh because they all recognize, they're like, oh, I remember when I had the semen on my ear. So it's sort of a universal thing.
Did that gag actually come from real life?
No, that one
didn't think, right.
We don't, yeah, we make some of them up.
You know, the truth of the matter is that's one of our, you know, people always ask us, say, hey, who wrote that joke? Who wrote this joke? Well, you know, we never quite remember, because it's usually not one person. It's sort of like somebody has an idea and someone pushes it further. And that's like a great example of how we write. You know, I had actually, this Pete, I had actually thought at some point, well, what would happen if you were masturbating and you lost the product, you know, and you couldn't find it? But I thought, well, you can't really do that. But I ran it by Bob. I said, is this doable in a movie if, you know, somebody lost? He said, yeah, you could. But then what happens? I said, geez, I don't know. He said, well, think about it. That's what's interesting. Where is it? And he said, well, I mean, like, what if it was on the guy's ear and he doesn't know it? And now we're laughing and thinking, that's funny. It's on his ear. Well, what could be a good situation? Now it's on his ear. We said, what if he's going to have a date or something, you know? And it goes to the next thing. All of a sudden, she's there. She sees it. What would she think it is? And then, you know, someone says, well, what if she thought it was, I don't know, he could say it's hair gel. And then, you know, literally like 20 minutes later, somebody says, well, what if she thought it was hair gel? She might put it in her hair. And we're laughing. And then another hour later, it's like, well, wait a second. Wouldn't it harden? And all of a sudden, you know, that's a day's work for us.
That was a good day, too.
Now, since you're often working in territory that people find really embarrassing, the kind of sexual and body function territory, have you learned ways not to do the gags, ways where it's either going to be too gross or too embarrassing or not funny enough and it won't work?
Well, I'll give you an example of one that we did, and it's not necessarily a bodily function gag, but it was one of the first days we were ever shooting on Dumb and Dumber, and we were on the mountain and up in the snow, and we came up with the idea of shooting this little scene where Lauren Holly picks up a little snow and gently throws it to at Jeff Daniels, and he being dumb and dumber, you know, doesn't know how to play, so he rolls up a big snowball and just fires it off her face, you know? And when we told him to do that, I remember he was like, what? Well, you know, why would I do that? I think, well, because you're dumb. And all right, I'll do it. We weren't sure if it would work or not. Well, when we showed it to an audience, they just howled laughing that he would hit this hit Lauren in the face with a snowball. But we had made a mistake. When she came up with the snow in her face, we had put a little drop of blood under her nose. And the audience went from just howling laughter to, when they saw the blood, it just stopped. There's no more laughter, and the reason why, of course, is because she's been hurt. And we were thinking to ourselves, man, we made a mistake putting that in. So we actually had to go back and digitally remove the blood spot from under her nose. And once we did, the audience just kept laughing and laughing and laughing, and it was just someone getting hit by a snowball. No one's hurt. So it's like, you occasionally do make a mistake by going too far, and that was a rule we learned, is that if someone gets hurt, all of a sudden it's not funny. If someone just gets embarrassed, it can remain very funny.
My guests are the Farrelly brothers. Here's a scene from Dumb and Dumber. Jim Carrey and Jeff Daniels are on the road. They've just picked up a hitchhiker, not realizing that he's actually a thug who's after a suitcase of money that they inadvertently picked up. The thug is sitting in between the ever-oblivious Carrey and Daniels, who are kidding around.
You double-stamped it, no erases. Cannot. Triple-stamped it, no erases. Touch blue, make it true. You can't triple-stamp a double-stamp. You can't triple-stamp a double-stamp, Lloyd. You can't triple-stamp a double-stamp. Lloyd! You
guys! Enough!
Hey, want to hear the most annoying sound in the world?
Guys! Guys! Guys!
Fellas, you think we could listen to the radio or something?
Radio? Who needs a radio? Ready, Harry? Mock!
Yeah!
Ing!
Yeah!
Bird!
Yeah!
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 Mockingbird! Don't everybody have you heard?
Have you heard?
She's gonna buy me a mockingbird!
We'll talk more with Peter and Bobby Farrelly after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guests are the Farrelly brothers, and their new comedy, Stuck on You, stars Matt Damon and Greg Kinnear. Your father, you know, we're talking about all the body humor in your movies. Your father is a doctor. You know, doctors have to have a very straightforward attitude about the body. So what kind of attitude about, you know, bodily functions were you brought up with in your house?
Well, you know, we weren't walking around, you know, ripping them, I will say. You know, they basically, you know, bodily functions were, you know, kept in check pretty well. You know, our actual, you know, verbal humor, we were given a lot more leeway.
I remember one time my father told me a story where he had a guy come in and he was giving him a physical checkup, and the guy was saying he had a little bit of a burn going on or something down in his privates. And he said, well, okay, we're going to need you to take a sample for us then. And he sends the guy in the other room to get a urine sample in a little jar. And the guy's in there like 10 or 15 minutes and comes back, and he has a sperm sample in there. And he had handed it to the nurse. And they got a kick out of that one. He didn't want to embarrass the guy. He said, okay, great. Threw it in the trash. All right, can you give me a urine sample now? That'd be great.
In a lot of your movies, the main character has some kind of like disability or shortcoming, whether it's that he's incredibly stupid or he's a bowler who has like a rubber prosthetic hand, or they're conjoined twins, as in Stuck on You. Did you go through your early years thinking that you had some kind of real handicap?
No, you know, we had a very, very nice upbringing. You know, I would say the only way, you know, at times we felt like outcasts because we were sent away to many schools. We weren't good students. But other than that, we had the same group of friends in our town. And, you know, we fit in. You know, we weren't outcasts at all. But, you know, we're just drawn to people with disabilities because, you know, well, for one thing, we know a lot. You know, we've been involved in the Best Buddies program for a long time, which is a mentoring program for people with mental retardation. And, you know, so we've hung around a lot of people with that disability. And also a friend of ours named Danny Murphy broke his neck when we were kids, and he's a quadriplegic. And, you know, through him, we've met a lot of other people with disabilities. So I think we're just comfortable around that type of person, and we like them and feel, you know, we want to write about them.
Were you shy around girls when you were, say, in high school? Because most of your male characters have real problems with women because they think of themselves as too ugly or too stupid, or they just don't get it.
Yeah, we were not particularly good with women, nor are we now. But I think what we try to accomplish in the movie with the guys is that they shoot out of their league. You know, like in Something About Mary, I think that Ben Stiller's character would just, you know, fell for Mary, and I think that there was a part of him who just thought she's the best woman in the world, and I don't know that I'm the best guy in the world, but I love her, you know. I go, I think deep down he thinks that she's out of his league, which she is.
But, you know, the thing, you know, the reason I think that movie crossed over in women as well as guys liked it is because of the one scene in it where, you know, he hires a private eye, the private eye finds her, falls in love with her, comes back and says, reports that she's put on a lot of weight and she's on welfare, she's been married a bunch of times, has a lot of kids out of wedlock, and so on and so forth. And he lies in bed that night and thinks about it, and he comes back next day and says, I still got to find her. He says, why? He says, well, I can't just turn it off like that. I still feel something. And I think that's the moment in the movie where women say, okay, he deserves her. Because, you know, obviously it's not hard to fall in love with Cameron Diaz.
Right, right. Let me ask you about Shallow Hal. And this is a movie in which Jack Black plays somebody who has, I mean, you know, he's a young man who isn't very good at getting girlfriends. And, of course, the girls he's attracted to are really beautiful and, you know, quote, out of his league. But he's kind of put under this hypnotic spell, so he sees the beauty underneath the surface. So no matter how somebody looks physically, he sees who they really are. So even if they're like obese, if they're beautiful inside, he will see them as a physically beautiful person. And that's what happens with Gwyneth Paltrow. She's actually quite fat, but because she's, you know, a beautiful person, he sees her as how Gwyneth Paltrow really looks. How did you come up with the concept for that film?
There was actually a concept that a friend of ours pitched to us, Sean Moynihan. And what's interesting about it is that Sean has a eye disease called macular degeneration, where he is legally blind. And so he you know, lives his life differently than everyone because, I mean, if he's with a girl, if somebody sets him up, he'd be like coming over, be like, how's she look? He actually has a hard time almost forming his opinion about how she looks physically because he can just barely see her. So he's a guy who needs to look, you know, more inside someone, as I'm sure all blind people do. And he came up with this idea, well, what if a guy was hypnotized where he just saw the inside of someone, just saw their recognized inner beauty, and, you know, to him, and that's what he saw. So we thought, that's a novel idea. That's real interesting. So collectively, we wrote the script.
You know, the press kind of jumped on this. There was a, you know, sort of a couple people yapping about it, saying that, you know, it was making fun of overweight people, and it was the furthest from the truth. In fact, you know, that movie was really celebrating inner beauty and saying that, you know, it doesn't matter how you are on the outside. It's all about what's inside. And it was sort of disheartening to us to have to answer so many questions about that because we felt that the movie spoke for itself. But for some reason, it seemed like there was just there were a couple people who had an agenda at the time. And I think they confused some people. And I think people stayed away from it, some people, because they thought we were making fun of heavy people, which we weren't.
The Farrelly Brothers will be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Available at 1-877-213-7374 or on the internet at www.burrells.com. Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by Universal Pictures, presenting Seabiscuit, based on the true story of an American legend, starring Tobey Maguire, Jeff Bridges, and Chris Cooper. Available on DVD and video. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
His friends would say, stop whining, they've had enough of that. His friends would say, stop pining, there's other girls to look at.
Coming up, we continue our conversation with filmmakers Peter and Bobby Farrelly, and Ken Tucker reviews two stripped-down CDs, Randy Newman's album of solo recordings and the Beatles' Let It Be Naked.
Mary, there's just something about Mary. Well, his friends say, look, life's no fairy tale, that he should have some fun, he's suffered long enough. Well, they may know about domestic and imported ale, but they don't know a thing about love. Well, his friends would say he's dreaming and living in the past, but they've never fallen in love, so his friends need not be asked. His friends would say, be reasonable. His friends would say, let go. But there's something about Mary that they don't know. Mary, there's just something about.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Peter and Bobby Farrelly. Their new film, Stuck on You, stars Matt Damon and Greg Kinnear as conjoined twins. Here's a scene from their film, There's Something About Mary. It's a flashback to Ben Stiller's prom night. He's at his date Mary's house in her bathroom. His privates are caught in the zipper of his fly, and everyone is coming to the rescue. Mary's parents, a policeman, and a fireman. Here's the fireman calling for backup.
Mike! Eddie! Get down here quick! Bring everybody! Bring a camera! You're not gonna believe this! We got a kid down here! What's your name?
No,
there's only one thing to do here.
Wait, you know what? I got an idea. Look, I can just... We don't have to do anything, because, look, I can just wear this over the front.
Look, I can go to the prom. We'll deal with it later.
Relax. You already laid the tracks. That's the hard part. Now we're just going to back it up.
Teddy, be brave.
It's just like pulling off a Band-Aid. A one. And a two. And a...
We got a bleeder! Keep the pressure on. Keep it on. Everybody get out of the way, buddy.
What do you think you get out of working as a team most of the time that you wouldn't be able to do if you were working individually?
That's a really good question because, in fact, that's, you know, there are a lot of brother teams out there today, the Coens, Farrellys, Wachowskis, Hughes, you know, Weitzes and Zuckers, so on and so forth. And I think if you look at each brother team, they're pretty distinctive. They all have a very distinctive point of view. And what you're able to do when you have a brother is you're able to defend that, you know, vision sounds a little artsier than it is, really, but you're able to defend your point of view. You know, if you're one person and you go in and you try to do something about Mary, the studio is going to be like, whoa, what are you doing here? This is a little much, you know. And you could be beaten down where you're saying, okay, and you're compromising. But when there's two of you, if I start getting weak, this is Pete speaking, Bob will say, don't back down now. Now, you know, and vice versa. If I see him weakening, I'm like, no, Bob, this is what we can do. We lift each other up, and we're able to see that through and basically, you know, fight the fights better.
You didn't intend to become filmmakers when you were in college or even when you got out of college. I think you were both had businesses, failing businesses, beforehand. And which of you went to Hollywood first?
Well, I went about a minute before Bob. I had actually, Bob had a round beach towel company at the time called Sunspot. And he was driving that into the ground. And at the same time, I was learning how to write. You know, I'd gone back to grad school for creative writing short stories and stuff. And on a whim, a friend of mine, Bennett Yellen and myself, we got a book, you know, Screenplay by Sid Field. And, you know, it basically explains the format of a screenplay. And we whipped one off, and lo and behold, it sold. So I was out there, and then Bob followed. And then, Bob started editing all our screenplays, and then a couple years later in 87, Bob jumped on board and there's been no looking back.
Bobby, how come a beach towel company, that's the first business that you started? I mean, why did you decide beach towels of all things?
Well, when I came out of school, I studied geology in school. And when I came out, I thought, what did I just do? I got a degree in geology, which is interesting to me, but there were no jobs in geology or anything. So I really didn't know what to do with myself. And I became I became a stockbroker and not a very good one and kind of struggled at it and just wasn't good at it at all. And while we were doing this, a friend of mine and myself was sitting around thinking of harebrained ideas of trying to do something different. And we came up with this scheme to make round beach towels. And the idea was that when you're at the beach, you have to get up and you move your towel as the sun moves across the sky. But we thought, hey, how about a big 6-foot round towel that you can kind of just move on? I've never seen that. That seems novel. And so we dropped everything we were doing in our lives, and we started a company, went out to California, and invested what little money we had into trying to make this company work. And after about 3 years of struggling, we kind of came to the realization that, you know, people really don't mind moving their towels over the course of the day.
Did I mention that Bob's a pot smoker? No, but, the whole Hollywood thing, honestly, it was one of those, like, you know, and I've talked about this before, you know, we were lucky enough to, you know, be unsuccessful enough so that we could attempt something crazy enough, like going to Hollywood and trying to get into the movie business, because we really had nothing to lose, and that was our gift.
How did you get to direct your first film, Dumb and Dumber? Sure, you'd want to do it, but why would the studio trust you to do it?
No trust involved.
We had written, we'd always write a script and we'd hope, geez, we hope we can find some director who wants to make this into a movie. And somewhere along, we could never do it. We might get close, but we couldn't get any guy who was going to take our script and run with it. We just couldn't get that far. So somewhere along the way, we thought, well, what if we say that, what if we attach ourselves as directors? And the idea was that we'd shoot a real low-budget movie and we'd keep it real simple and, maybe we could direct it ourselves, seeing that we couldn't get someone else to do it. And so the script that we chose was Dumb and Dumber. It had been passed by all the studios in town, and we thought it's a simple enough movie. We thought we could shoot it real cheap. And right around then, our producer, Charlie Wessel, happened to get it into Jim Carrey's hands, and Jim was nowhere near the big star that he is now, but he wanted to make this movie Dumb and Dumber. And like lightning, his career took off right then. And so all the big studios wanted to do the next Jim Carrey movie, and it just happened to be Dumb and Dumber with us attached as directors. And when they came in, they never asked us what qualifications we had to direct it, because they came in after us, and they basically just forgot to fire us.
Yeah, they were so tickled about having Jim Carrey, they were sort of blinded by the fact that these, banana heads were hanging on directing it. And we hadn't directed a video, we hadn't directed a commercial, we hadn't been on a movie set more than a half hour. And we kept waiting for the hammer to come down and them say, well, wait, why you? They just never did. So that's why I say it's not that they trusted us, it's just that,
they were negligent.
Totally negligent. And the crew is so good that when we started Dumb and Dumber, though the studio itself didn't know that we were doing, we were very honest with the crew right off the bat. We told the director of photography and first AD and all the stuff. We said, look, we this is a joke that we're here. We have no idea what we're doing. So if you we need your help. And they did. They pulled us through. They would. I didn't know when to yell action at the beginning of the movie. I'd look to the AD and he'd point to me and an action. The point is, the reason there weren't the big glitches and the problems that you would expect is because the crew is so good. They do their job. They're there on everything. It's like clockwork, and all you have to do is worry about getting that performance from the actor.
My guests are Peter and Bobby Farrelly. Their new film is called Stuck on You. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guests are the Farrelly brothers. Their films include Dumb and Dumber, There's Something About Mary, and Shallow Hal. Their new film is Stuck on You. I want to ask you about one of your movies that is not one of your best-known films. It's Kingpin, and it's a really funny film. It's out on DVD if anyone wants to see it. But this is a movie that's about bowling, and it combines elements of, like, The Hustler, and it's as if bowling were like this big arena sport, which of course it's not, with ESPN coverage and everything. And it's really funny. Bill Murray and Woody Harrelson, Randy Quaid star in it. What made you want to do a movie about, somebody whose dream is to be the bowling champion and he's got a prosthetic hand?
Bradley Thomas, who produces all our movies, found that script. It was an old script that had been lying around, and we got in and punched it up, and we just, I don't know, it struck us as, we're not bowlers, more than anyone else, you bowl once a year or something, and we'd been wanting to work with Woody Harrelson, who we knew for a long time, and it just seemed perfect for him. That movie's very, very close to our hearts because it didn't do well, and we really loved it. Our first movie was Dumb and Dumber. It came out. It was a big hit, and then we made Kingpin, and we really loved it. We figured, well, that'll be a big hit, and when it came out and did no business, it was just, it was devastating. It really, it's hard to believe you could be so wounded by a movie not doing well, but it hurt. And it wasn't until about 6 months later when it came out on a video that started catching on. And in fact, to this day, is probably more people approach us about that movie than any of our movies.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, because it's kind of taken on sort of a cult status. And, you know, people. I think people figure, you know, we hear it all the time about Dumb and Dumber and Something About Mary. But, you know, people seem pretty fanatical about that one.
Yeah, and Bill Murray was just too damn funny in it. I mean, he really, I could go back and watch him three times in a row just because of Bill. He was just, I thought, genius in it.
Well, how much improvisation is there in most of your movies?
I would say in most of them, you know, we always keep the door open for improv. We shoot what's on the script, and then we ask them when we have it, okay, now just wing it, see what you got there. But with Bill Murray, and he's the only one, you know, who's done this and the only one we would want to do this, he literally, you know, he looks at the script and just throws the pages on the floor and he said, I get it. And then he wings it. And he always comes up with better stuff than we could have envisioned.
Is that pure fun to work with, or is it also a little scary because you don't know what you're going to get?
Well, you don't know what you're going to get, but you got a pretty good feeling that it's going to be good.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, it's scary to work with Bill just because he's such a you know, force of nature, and he, you know, it was a little intimidating to try to go over and give him comic direction because we felt like here's a guy we looked up to our whole life, and he knows so much more about it than us that was a little intimidating. But he was a lot of fun to work with, and he's a great guy too.
You know, I remember one time actually we approached him. All right, I approached him, this is Pete, and I said, you know, I gave him some advice on the scene. I said, well, why don't you try it this way? I remember he said, oh, yeah, the obvious choice. and then I just backed off and just never said another word. But he nailed it.
In your new movie, there's this fantastic dog. It's just a big, gorgeous, gray, fuzzy, wonderful dog. And there are animals in most of your movies, though they're often like stuffed animals. playing real animals. There's the animal car and Dumb and Dumber and a lot of animal stuff in that. Do you guys have pets?
Yeah, we both have a lot of pets. We grew up with many pets and ducks and geese, and my dad actually brought home a monkey one time on Mother's Day and gave it to my mom, and I don't know exactly what he was thinking, but that was a lot of fun to have around the house for a while.
Yeah, we're big on animals.
And why do you like to use animals a lot in your movies?
Well, you know, it's, I'm trying to think. You know, people are...
There are a lot of things we do in our movies that we don't know why.
We
know that we do them, but we don't know why. And I always look at it like a good golfer, you know, probably shouldn't look at his swing and because it might screw him up to try to analyze it. And we just do what we think's funny, and we don't particularly have particular reasons for everything, but yeah, the animal thing is a recurring theme. I think this is the first movie that we've made where we haven't used really. There's not much animal humor in Stuck on You, but hopefully we'll get back to it.
We actually are though developing a script, and it was called Party Animals at one time. It's a an animated movie about a bunch of lab animals. There's a rat and a pigeon, a few other things. Who are, you know, they're basically being tested for everything, high doses of nicotine and alcohol and drugs and everything. And what happens is an animal rights group breaks into this lab and frees them and sets them out, you know, sends them out in the streets of Manhattan. And basically they all start getting the shakes, you know, they're looking for cigarettes and trying to find weed. And,
they're very upset when they get freed.
Yeah, they want back in. But in the meantime,
really
it's a riot. It's being written by Peter Gawky and Jerry Swallow, who had the idea for it. And it's a real riot. It would be an R-rated animated movie, to say the least.
If you're just joining us, my guests are the Farrelly Brothers. Their new comedy is called Stuck on You. In your new movie, Stuck on You, about the conjoined twins, they have a diner in which they flip burgers, and one of the people who works at the diner is developmentally disabled. And he, I believe, is played by a person who actually is developmentally disabled.
His name's Rocket. He's basically playing himself. Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh. Does he work at a shop like that?
No, he doesn't, but his name's Rocket Valliere, and he's a friend of ours from home, and he's his character is the same as we know him, but I'm sorry, go ahead.
How did you approach him to be in the movie?
He's a fantastically interesting guy who, he's a savant. He is developmentally disabled, but he's a savant too, and he knows more about movies and movie lore and movie history and actresses and actors than any three people I know combined. And don't even know how he knows it all, but he has an encyclopedic knowledge about everything in the business. So he's wildly entertaining and is infatuated with anything to do with the movie. So we know him. We're very friendly with him. We always thought that we'd love to put him in a movie and give him a good part. And in Stuck on You, he came up with the perfect situation.
Did you know him? Like, how long have you known him?
We've known him about 10 years or so. Mm-hmm. He's is good friends with a guy we know named Tommy Songen, who is a hockey player. Grew up near us, actually. He played at Mount St. Charles Academy in Rhode Island, and then for the Boston Bruins for a time. But we see him around quite a bit, and he had bumped into Rocket about 15 years ago in a diner. Rocket was having lunch alone. He saw him there several days in a row, and finally invited him to his table. And they've ended up, sort of best friends. They take care of each other. You know, Tommy thinks he's taking care of Rocket, and Rocket thinks he's taking care of Tommy. And I don't know who's right, but we see them all the time. And Rocket is such a great character and interesting guy. We just wanted to get his mug up there and get him talking. It's just, you know, it was fun to have him on the set, and it was fun to put him in the movie.
Yeah. Well, and one of the last things that happened was we were shooting a dance number where he was actually dancing with Meryl Streep. And after they finished their take, we yelled cut, and we gave him, you know, an applause because they had done a nice job. And all of a sudden, Rocket was up there on the stage, and he just kind of became inspired, and he sang Old Man River for us, which was like, wow, that was great. And we clapped again. And then he went into this spontaneous, like an acceptance speech, like he had just won the Oscar, and he gave this beautiful, moving speech thanking all the people in his life who were important, and we just kind of kept the cameras rolling on it. And you know, people in the crew would watch him and just crying watching. You know, he's such a beautiful guy, Rocket. Anyway, because we had filmed it, we thought it might be a nice little something to put in the end credits. So at the very end of the movie, that Rocket's acceptance speech is there.
Thank you so much for talking with us.
Hey, thank you,
thank
Terry.
You. Thanks a lot, Terry.
Real pleasure.
The Farrelly Brothers. Their new film is called Stuck on You. Coming up, rock critic Ken Tucker reviews stripped-down CDs featuring Randy Newman and the Beatles. This is Fresh Air. A new version of the Beatles' 1970 final album has been released. It's called Let It Be Naked, and it removes much of the elaborate production imposed on the Beatles' tracks by producer Phil Spector. At the same time, singer-songwriter Randy Newman has released the Randy Newman Songbook Volume 1, the first of a projected 3-volume set of Newman performing his songs solo, backing himself on piano. Rock critic Ken Tucker listened to both and finds new pleasure in one of them.
The long and winding road that leads to your door will never disappear. I've seen that road before. Lead me to you.
If that version of the Beatles' long and winding road sounds different from the one you carry around in your head, it's because it's been stripped clean of the string section and orchestration imposed on it by Phil Spector. In 1969, you'll recall, the Beatles were breaking up. Paul McCartney wanted to make one more album, and the other three of the Fab Four relented, dragging themselves, producer George Martin, and Yoko Ono into the studio. To make a long, acrimonious story short, Lennon, having fought with McCartney, asked his pal Spector to see what he could do with the tracks. McCartney denounced the work, but let it be released. Now Capitol Records has put out bare-bones versions of the songs. Are they better?
When I find myself in times of trouble, Mother Mary comes to me, speaking words of wisdom, let it be. And in my hour of darkness, she is standing right in front of me, speaking words of wisdom, let it be. Let it be, let it be, let it be, let it be. Whisper words of wisdom, let it be. And when the broken...
Now remember, Let It Be was never considered a great album anyway. I don't think this does much to enhance its reputation either. McCartney, Ringo, and Yoko have all signed off on this naked version. So the de-shellacking of Phil Spector is out there for fans, but it's not as though the original is being taken off the shelves. Market concerns, that is, squeezing more Beatles sales by Capitol Records, seems to be the primary reason for this project. By contrast, I'll bet no one at Nonesuch Records thinks that stripping away the rock and roll backing Randy Newman had on the 1979 recording of It's Money That I Love is going to bring Newman and the record company more money.
Don't love the mountain. Sister, small like my dad, good like my mama. It's money that I love. It's money that I love. You say that money.
If anything, the starkness of the sound on the Randy Newman songbook emphasizes the gleeful misanthropy that Newman was aiming for the first time around, when in the 70s and 80s he was still trying to crack the pop charts and rock audiences. His idiosyncratic piano style, a mixture of New Orleans barrel house playing with classically trained fills and precision, sounds wonderful coming from his 59-year-old hands. Judy Collins made a maudlin hit out of that Newman song in 1966. Newman himself orchestrated it into pathos on his debut album 2 years later. This version carefully reveals I Think It's Going to Rain Today for what it really is, a suicide note. Later on, he takes one of his greatest, most meticulously ruthless songs, The Great Nations of Europe, and makes a pure masterpiece of it.
Gathered on the shore, they conquered what was behind them, but now they wanted more, so they looked to the mighty ocean, they took to the western sea, the great nations of Europe in the 16th century. Hide your wives and daughters, hide the groceries too, great nations of Europe coming through. The Grand Canary Islands.
These days, lots of people know Randy Newman primarily by the jaunty or florid movie soundtracks he writes. Whether it's You Got a Friend in Me from Toy Story, or his dew-lapped horse manure in Seabiscuit. As he recently told NPR's Bob Edwards, if Disney pays me enough money, I can turn it out. On the Randy Newman songbook, it's not money that he loves, it's the pride in his art, which he'd probably call craft. Even in the balkanizing context of current pop music, the Beatles and Randy Newman are still opposites. Culture-changing collaborators compared to stubborn, solitary cult creator. But it's the Randy Newman project that I won't let be. I've got a feeling it won't let me down.
Ken Tucker is critic at large for Entertainment Weekly. He reviewed The Beatles' Let It Be, Naked, and the Randy Newman songbook, Volume 1. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Julian Hertzfeld. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Ian Chillog directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.
I've been around the world, had my pick of any girl. You'd think I'd be happy, but I'm not. Everybody knows my name, but it's just a crazy game. Oh, it's lonely at the top. Listen to the band they're playing just for me.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble Books, publishers of Joel Myrowitz's new volume of photography, Tuscany, Inside the Light, with text by Maggie Barrett, available at Barnes & Noble Bookstores and online at bn.com. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, by Starbucks, makers of eggnog lattes, peppermint mochas, and gingerbread lattes, available this holiday season at Starbucks. And from Nonesuch Records, featuring composer Thomas Newman's soundtrack for the film version of Angels in America, a two-part, six-hour event presentation on HBO. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Christianity as we recognize it today really began in the 4th century. What did the religion look like before that? On the next Fresh Air, religion scholar Bart Ehrman. His new books collect and analyze the early Christian texts that didn't make it into the canon. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.